Yeah, very, very sort of good to just be in the shrine room with so many people, just saluting the shrine together. I was thinking, in a way, we could just sit here and I wouldn't have to say anything, and it would still be a very, very positive evening. Very, very good to... maybe it would be even more of a positive evening. We'll wait and see. But very, very good to see you all here. Yes, I want to start by talking more personally, so I hope you'll indulge me in that. Today is, as Subhadramati has implied, a very significant anniversary for me, marking, as it does, the day of my public ordination. I was ordained in India and with five other men, and I've just received an email from one of them, who's at the Frey Retreat Centre with Subhuti, who was our preceptor, on retreat now, and he was saying that him and Subhuti have been thinking of all of us. So it's very, very nice. That's very alive for me in my mind. But the day is also a significant anniversary of another event in my life that's had a profound effect on me. So 36 years ago today, my father died. So yes, it's a double sort of anniversary. His death and my ordination 22 years later are very much linked for me. It's almost as if his death started me on a quest for meaning that seemed to reach some sort of resolution and culmination, or certainly a new phase, 22 years later to the day, with my entering into the Sri Ratna Buddhist order. He died quite suddenly, sort of unexpectedly. I was 11 at the time, and it was obviously a sort of shattering kind of experience, but not an unmixed experience. Not just shattering in a sort of negative way, because, as I say, one of the things that it started to form in me is a questioning about what life is. What are we doing if somebody can just drop dead? In fact, not can drop dead, if we will all drop dead at some point, if we will all die. What are we doing? And as an 11-year-old, I wasn't able to sort of answer anything, but I was old enough to start questioning. And in a way, I hadn't yet become conditioned by all the adult behaviours around me, because all the adults around me seem to know what to do in life. They seem to know that you finish your education, you got a job, you settled down, maybe you had a family, you got a house, you got a mortgage to enable you to get a house, you might get a bigger house, you go on holiday. That's what life was, and then you died. But they forgot to sort of mention that last bit, do you see what I mean? And I kept saying, well, that can't be right. I didn't know how to formulate that. But given that we die, surely there had to be more. For me also, I had imaginative propensity to... look at mystery, and my dad's death gave me an opportunity to question what was somehow beyond death. And one of the very, very strong experiences that I had, and in fact still continue to have, is that death isn't the end, that death wasn't the end. I felt a communication with my father continue. I can't really... explain that to you. It's not, and certainly I can't prove that that's what was going on. Any skeptic would say, okay, you were just grieving and trying to make sense of your loss. But for me, it was more than that. It was an actual communication with my father, a two-way communication that continued, well, in some ways continues to this day, although not so much in that same form. You don't actually have to believe in some continuity after death to be a Buddhist. Bhante Sangharakshita is very clear about that. You can practice Buddhism just for improving this life and improving the world around us. You don't have to take on board anything that you haven't experienced for yourself. Buddhism doesn't believe in that sort of blind, well, it doesn't have a place for blind belief. Nevertheless, I'm just saying that for me personally, that was somehow an intrinsic part of my experience that made me question what was going on. Because if death wasn't the end, then what kept coming up for me was, well, then that meant that life was somehow more meaningful than I knew. What was life about if death wasn't the end? Another strand for me in my childhood was that I was very attracted to, space and the cosmos and sort of trying to uncover meaning through a wider perspective, stars and galaxies and the cosmos. And I can remember as a kid, I mean, I was born in Kenya, and as a two and a half year old, I was 2 and a half when we moved to England, when we emigrated to England. And men, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, hadn't landed on the moon yet. But I think there must have been a lot of build-up to that moon landing. Because in my mind, I was sort of obsessed, I can remember, with the moon and landing on the moon, going to the moon. I was a very late developer in terms of, well, loads of ways, actually. But particularly in terms of speech and language. So even as a two-year-old, I didn't really speak Gujarati, which was my mother tongue, or English. I had my own sort of monosyllabic language that I developed and somehow my parents indulged me in. And I don't know what the word for moon was. It's probably something like ung, because most of my words seem to sound like that. But I can remember coming, I knew that I was going to go on an aeroplane to come to England, although I didn't realise, I didn't quite know where I was going. I just knew that I was going to come on an aeroplane. And I wasn't sure what the difference was between an aeroplane and a rocket. And in my mind, I thought we might be going to the moon. Which is what was very, very exciting as this wee toddler. And I can remember as a kid, me and my sister, when we came to England, we had this sort of sofa, this sort of three-seater settee that was like a sofa bed. It sort of could turn. It could flip, actually. I've never seen a sofa like that again. But you could sort of sit on it and flip it and end up upside down on it, as it were, on the other side. Anyway, that was our space rocket. And we'd flip it upside down, and on the other side was the moon. And basically what we did was take giant steps on the other side. That was the sort of sum of our going to the moon. But that childhood infatuation sort of stayed with me as I grew up, and I think it was a strand in my wanting to study physics at university, wanting to sort of understand what space was, what time was, what the cosmos was, what matter was. That strand has continued as a sort of fascination in my life. Recently I went to see a film that touched me very deeply, and it wasn't until afterwards that I sort of realised why it had moved me so deeply. It's a film called, it came out last year, and some of you might have seen it. It's called Nostalgia for the Light. It's a Chilean documentary, and I think it's a masterpiece. In fact, it's not just me that thinks it's a masterpiece. The Guardian reviewed it as a masterpiece. I just want to say a little bit about that film and why it moved me. It is set in the Atacama Desert, which is the highest desert in the world, and it's in Chile. And at that, it's the only place on Earth that has zero humidity. It's so high and so desert-like, there is no humidity at all, which gives the atmosphere a unique quality. One of the qualities is that it makes the air incredibly clear. So the world's astronomers have gathered in the Atacama Desert to build some of the largest telescopes that we've got to study the stars, to study the cosmos. And this film, one strand of the film, is talking, just interviewing some of these cosmologists who are studying the stars, and it's very, very moving and breathtakingly beautiful. And what they talk about is looking for meaning through looking into the heavens. And when you study the stars, you're looking back in time. The universe is said to be 13.7 billion years old, and some of what they can observe is almost that old. And you're looking back to worlds, to stars that were that old. And all the elements of all the atoms that are heavier than hydrogen are formed in stars. And one of the astronomers says, so that means that we are made up of stars. We are made up of stardust, literally. All the elements, apart from hydrogen, are made up in stars. And in fact, anything heavier than iron is really, really rare, because most stars don't produce anything heavier than iron. Every so often you've got this supermassive star that at the end of its life collapses in on itself and then explodes. It explodes into what's called a supernova, which is one of the brightest, most fantastic events in the whole universe. And it's only in that explosion that heavier elements like gold or anything heavier than iron is made. So everything that is heavier than iron in the universe happened in supernovas. So they're looking for meaning in looking back and out at the cosmos. And there's something very moving for me about that, looking for something that feels very significant. I can't say why, but it feels very significant. Somehow our place in the cosmos gives me a bigger perspective on what it is to be alive, what it is to be human. But there's another strand to this film. The strand that is perhaps even more moving is rather more, also more horrific, because in the Atacama Desert in the 70s, when Pinochet was in power, there was a concentration camp where he... Where thousands of his victims were disappeared to, and then buried in mass graves in the desert. And because of the unique lack of humidity in that desert, bodies are preserved for much, much longer. And so what you've got today in the Atacama Desert is women, mothers, sisters, daughters of the men who disappeared, scouring the desert, literally with their hands and with spades, looking for the bodies of their loved ones. And one woman says, you know, these telescopes that are turned towards the skies, I just wish they could also be turned towards the ground. There's this 70-year-old woman, maybe she's more than that, who's interviewed and says she's not very fit anymore. She goes out every day, that she can, and she says she knows she hasn't got long to live, but she doesn't want to die until she's found the remains of her son, and then she'd be happy to die. Very, very moving interviews. A woman who did find the remains of her brother. All that they found actually was a foot in a boot, and they managed to identify him, and she says how she came downstairs that night and held the boot and the foot. And it was for her both a profound relief after so many years. She knew that he was dead, and a shattering realization that he was dead. Very, very moving film. And what I realized was that, some of the interviewers actually make the connection that both strands of activity are looking for meaning. There's this cosmic perspective in the face of mortality, in the face of death, and both people are looking for meanings. One of the astronomers says, yes, we're both looking for meaning in the past, and the interviewer says, well, so are there are there parallels? And he says, yes, there are lots of parallels between what I'm doing and what these women are doing. But he says there's a really important difference. He says, when I go home at night, I can sleep. And that's a really important difference. It's a very, very profound, poetic, beautiful documentary that I very much recommend. For me, it captured something of, at my own level, it captured something of my childhood quest for meaning, both in terms of a cosmic perspective and trying to answer questions about death. And I think that that is a universal quest for meaning that human beings have pursued since we were human. The Buddha to be saw those foresights of old age, sickness, and death, and then the fourth sight that seemed to point to a larger perspective, a wider perspective. That's what sparked his quest. So we've always asked, who are we? And what does it mean to be alive? And particularly, what does it mean to be mortal? And what does it mean to die? And I think any true spiritual path, needs to address both those perspectives, both those questions. The cosmic perspective and this personal, intensely personal perspective of suffering and death and all that that implies. I want to read you something that Karen Armstrong, the writer, she writes on religion and spirituality. She's written many, many books. She's a very, very wise woman. Interestingly, on YouTube, you can see interviews with where she was interviewing Sangharakshita Banti. I don't know when, but it was several decades ago. It's worth looking at. It's quite a long piece that I'm going to read you, and it's her talking about what the religious quest is. And I think it's really intelligent. She says, religious people are ambitious. They want lives overflowing with significance. They have always desired to integrate with daily lives the moments of rapture and insight that came to them in dreams, in their contemplation of nature, and in their intercourse with one another and with the animal world. Instead of being crushed and embittered by the sorrow of life, they sought to retain their peace and their serenity in the midst of their pain. They yearned for the courage to overcome their terror of mortality. Instead of being grasping and mean-spirited, they aspired to live generously, large-heartedly, and justly, and to inhabit every single part of their humanity. Instead of being a mere workaday cup, they wanted, as Confucius suggested, to transform themselves into a beautiful ritual vessel brimful of the sanctity they were learning to see in their life. They tried to honour the ineffable mystery they sensed in each human being and create societies that honour the stranger, the alien, the poor and oppressed. Of course, they often failed. But overall, they found that the disciplines of religion helped them to do all this. Those who applied themselves most assiduously showed that it was possible for mortal men and women to live on a higher, divine or godlike plane, and thus wake up to their true selves. Isn't that brilliant? Isn't that just brilliant? I really, really respond to this. She says that we're ambitious, that religious people are ambitious. They want to live lives that are brimful with the sanctity that they're learning to detect. It's not escapism, that's what I'm trying to say. It's moving into meaning, into depth, into life, into something sacred. But of course, religion has at times got it very wrong. And particularly when religions have started to take literally their own myths. and hardened them into dogma. Until recently, I would have said that Buddhism was relatively immune to this compared to the theistic religions, but then you look at what's happening in Burma and the awful conflict between Buddhists and Muslims in Burma, and I feel saddened, very, very saddened, that even people who consider themselves Buddhists are capable of getting it so, so, so wrong. Yes, so literalism is a real, real danger for any spiritual aspirant, both individually and collectively. And particularly the theistic religions have at times clung to their myths and their metaphors so strongly that they've rejected the truths that science is unfolding about what the cosmos is and the universe is. And Carl Sagan, who was a sort of childhood hero of mine, a cosmologist and astronomer, was very, very scathing of that sort of religion, that sort of religious dogmatic attitude. He said, how is it that hardly any major religion has looked at science and concluded, this is better than we thought. The universe is much bigger than our prophets said, grander, more subtle, more elegant. Instead, they say, no, 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 my God is a little God, and I want him to stay that way. A religion, old or new, that stressed the magnificence of the universe as revealed by modern science, might be able to draw forth reserves of reverence and awe hardly tapped by the conventional faiths. Sooner or later, such a religion will emerge. And for me, Buddhism is such a religion. And particularly as elucidated, interpreted by Sangharakshita, by Bhante Sangharakshita, I think it has a clarity that's unrivaled. I think that Buddhism, as I've received it, gives most comprehensive and clear ideas about both the goal and the path leading to that goal. So in the second part of my talk, I want to explore more about the Dharma, about Buddhism, the path and the goal. So Buddhism, of course, begins with an experience, the experience of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, his enlightenment experience, his awakening. It begins with that experience, but crucially, the Buddha taught is that he wasn't unique. He was a human being, and all human beings are capable of having the experience that he had, and that that experience is the culmination of our humanity, of the human condition. In fact, it goes beyond what we ordinarily conceive of as being human. One of the things Bhante has, one of the ways he's talked about enlightenment, at least once that I'm aware of, is he talks about enlightenment as the greatest possible perspective on everything. The greatest possible perspective on everything. And I think it was that I was intimating or intuiting when I, as a kid, wanted a cosmic perspective on life. That the enlightened mind, the perspective of a Buddha, I suspect goes even beyond that cosmic perspective. Because a cosmic perspective still implies, well, you've got this vastness of the cosmos, but I am still at the centre of the whole universe. I'm just looking out to wider and wider reaches. Whereas the perspective of the enlightened mind has no such centre, has no such centre of self, has no self-referential content at all. Not only does it not have a perspective that sees me or the self as the centre of everything, it doesn't regard the objective world as separate from consciousness. And here words start to reach their limitation, not just because we don't have the language, but because we strain at the very bounds of reason itself. starts to break down, when you start to move into terrain that goes beyond subject and object. But it's said that, yes, there is the possibility for all of us to experience an awareness, a vast awareness, an infinite awareness within us, as it were, but that is somehow not us, not ours. And yet we can experience it. I mean, the incredible thing about the enlightened mind is that it's this infinite consciousness that isn't personal. You could somehow talk about it in terms of universal consciousness, and I'm talking in metaphors here. We mustn't take that too literally. But perhaps you could think about it in some sort of cosmic universal consciousness. The incredible thing is that it is still contained within a human form, at least while the Buddha had a living body. It was contained within the finite. It's the infinite in the finite. And that infinite within the finite is our own birthright. The only thing that stops us experiencing it is this delusion that we have a fixed and separate self. A fixed and separate self. So Bhante's been talking about it, that when that delusion starts to be seen through, when that illusion is started to be seen as illusion, something new emerges in our experience. And initially, it's said that it feels like it's emerging from outside of us. Again, that's a metaphorical way of talking. But it's so unfamiliar to any experience that we can have that it feels like it's external to us and yet arising within us. Subhuti talks of a stream of mental states that are not selfishly based, that are not hinged or centred on self. Again, really hard to even imagine. And yet, it's our own, well, as I say, birthright. It's not something that needs to be foreign to us. We just have to learn how to get out of our own way. And this experience of something that transcends self, arising yet somehow within us, is said to operate along natural laws, just like the laws of physics. It's said that it arises in a natural way, that it's part of the fabric of reality. If only we could see it, as it were. It's natural, it's not supernatural in the sense of some sort of God or divine agency interfering with the natural order. It's part of the natural order. And Bhante has been talking more recently in terms of the law of karma and the law of dharma, both as natural laws. Niyamas is the word for law, karma niyama and dharma niyama. And those two natural laws that operate in reality are the key to this transcendent experience. It's by cooperating with these natural laws that we can transform our consciousness into the enlightened mind. So I want to say a little bit more, I'm not going to have time to say very much, about working first of all with the natural law of karma, and then working with the natural law of dharma, the karma niyama and the dharma niyama. So it's said that the karma niyama starts to operate, it arises, so to speak, when there is self-consciousness. When there are self-conscious beings who are aware of being aware, then the law of karma starts to operate for them. The law of gravity arises, for example, whenever there's matter and mass. Wherever there's matter and mass, the law of gravity manifests. So wherever there's self-consciousness, the law of karma manifests. It becomes operational. And in essence, well, we probably all know what the law of karma is saying. What it's saying is that all of our intentional actions will shape our future consciousness. Consciousness is changing all the time, moment to moment. And every time we act in an intentional way, we're shaping our own minds, our own future consciousness. And when we act selflessly, with greater love, greater generosity, greater awareness, then the mind that we bring into being is one that is broader, richer, more expansive, more creative, more aware, more positive, more filled with metta, and closer to the way things are, closer to seeing through the delusion of a fixed and separate selfhood. So we're moving in the direction of reality, of the enlightened mind, every time we act with kindness, with love, with generosity, with some awareness, with some degree of lack of self-concern. And of course the opposite is true. Every time we act in a way that is unskillful, as the term is, acting from the bonds of self, what we do is tighten those bonds in our own consciousness, and our consciousness becomes smaller, more rigid, less malleable, darker somehow, more constricted. We feel more isolated from other people and the world around us, and we feel therefore less happy. In essence, that's the law of karma. It goes beyond that, but I'm not going to talk about that at this moment. All that I am going to mention is that the law of karma isn't the only law operating in the universe, so we mustn't fall into the trap of thinking that everything that happens to us is the result of our past karmic actions. There are other laws, like the law of gravity, operating in the universe. A brick falls on our toe, it might not be anything to do with karma, it might be the law of gravity doing this thing. So in a way it's really good to not take life too personally. That is one of our tendencies, isn't it, to take it all very, very personally. So initially the spiritual life consists of aligning ourselves more and more with the positive aspect of the law of karma, so that we can develop this richer, brighter, more aware consciousness. And we do that through our ethical behaviour, our actions. We do that through meditation, where we're working directly on our minds to move them towards, transform them towards the skillful. We do that through cultivating right views, views that are going to lead to beneficial action. Views in Buddhism are judged by their effects, so they don't have a sort of intrinsic value so much as holding a certain view leads to a certain sort of behaviour. So if we did believe that death was the end and there was no more to life than trying to gain as much pleasure as we can and personal satisfaction as we can while we're alive, then that will lead to a whole way of living, a whole way of behaving. So views govern our behaviour. They're not academic things in Buddhism. They're vital. So part of working with the law of karma is to look at our views and to gradually move what we think about the world in the direction that's more helpful. But that's not enough. That's not enough, because you can do all of that and still we can end up with a sort of refined selfishness. And Buddhism might be particularly prone to this, because if you do act ethically, if you do meditate, if you do work on your views, you will become happier over time. And it's easy then to become a bit complacent, self-satisfied in one's own happiness, and still turn that into a more comfortable sort of self-created prison. that doesn't really break through the bonds of this delusion of self, fixed and separate selfhood. One way, and a really vital way, I think, of moving beyond ourselves is to serve something that is bigger than us. Serve a goal, an end that is bigger than us. A mortgage, a career, a family even, isn't always going to be able to do that. We need something that is sort of pointing to the transpersonal. And one way that we can do that in all sorts of ways. I mean, a lot of people find that through their altruistic work, for example. They're working to reduce suffering in the world. But one way that we can do that, and as Buddhists, a way that we really need to take seriously and consider very, very seriously, is can we work to help serve the Dharma, to help spread the Dharma? Because the Dharma is the most precious gift that can ever be offered to anybody, because it contains within it the path that not only alleviates suffering but transcends suffering. Serving the Dharma, serving that goal, can help lift us beyond self, beyond the confines of selfhood. I'm really, really pleased that at this centre, the Sangha consists of, all of us in some way or another are participating in this altruistic venture to serve the Dharma. Partly simply by being here, we're doing that. We're participating in this altruistic spirit. But many of us, many of you, are helping more directly, giving in whatever way you can to the project of serving the Dharma, helping spread the Dharma. The world needs the Dharma. This centre is like a tiny, tiny flame, a tiny beacon in a very dark and darkening world, I think. And it needs as much of our creativity, resources, energy, as much as we can muster. And that, to me, feels like a more meaningful, worthwhile life to be trying to lead than anything else that we can be doing with our lives. Frankly, that's how it feels to me. But also, if we do that, if we can start to serve the Dharma, then what happens is that we start to let go, we start to almost be forced to let go of egotism, at least to some degree. There's a sort of thinning of egotism. So, for example, we start to have to let go of pride, of our desire for success, in success in that worldly sense, of fame, of fortune, of specialness, of me as being this special, special centre of the universe. We start to, if you serve the Dharma, you're confronted with your own limitations, which you then have to confess, acknowledge, confession, apology, forgiveness, become essential. You can't serve the Dharma without participating in those practices, and those practices help refine, thin egotism. Yeah, we're learning to see ourselves not as the centre of the universe. That's hard. That's hard practice, and it needs to be based on a lot of emotional positivity. And hence you have these stages of integration and positive emotion that Maitra Bandhu is going to carry on exploring in the weeks to come. If we are going to let go of egotism, if the delusion that we're a fixed and separate selfhood, there's a delusion of fixed and separate entity within me, if we're going to let go of that, we also need to cultivate a confidence that when we let go, we're not going to disappear into a black hole, into a void where the lights just go out. We need to start cultivating confidence, or shraddha, in a reality that goes beyond our self-clinging. So confidence that if I can let go of selfhood, that actually what emerges is a freedom, and a joy and a bliss and a profound sense of truth and knowing, and a sense of connectedness with all of reality. We need to start to cultivate confidence that that is what will happen. Otherwise, it will be very, very difficult to let go of ourselves, particularly when the world around us is encouraging us to do the very exact opposite and telling us that true happiness is to be found through all of those worldly pursuits. Very, very difficult to do unless we cultivate this sense of Shraddha. And Shraddha can't just be an intellectual understanding. It also has to feel like a longing. A longing. There's a beautiful word which is a type of Shraddha, an aspect of Shraddha called Abhilasha, which is called the longing faith, the longing Shraddha, where we yearn for transcendence, where we yearn for truth, where we yearn to be free of these tight, limited bonds of self and the suffering that that creates. We have to long for meaning and truth in the way that we might long for a lover, or we might long for any worldly sort of happiness. If we can cultivate that sort of Shraddha, strengthen that, if we can use the law of karma by acting ethically, by meditating, by working on our views, if we can practice confession, apology, forgiveness, if we can loosen the bonds of egotism, then we're more ready, we're more placed for a yet deeper sort of letting go, a more deeper sort of realization. It's almost like this self-clinging that we're trying to let go of is it's like a reflex in our very, very being that goes, it's almost gut level. It's not going to just be intellectual or even emotional. It's like the survival instinct. It goes as deep. In fact, in a sense, it is the survival instinct. It goes as deep as that. So what we're trying to let go of is like a reflex that just is naturally clinging. It's like a muscle. Sometimes you can sort of feel that holding on in the pit of your stomach. And it's that, at that level, that we're trying to let go. And when we let go, or when we start to let go, it can feel like we're going to die. And that is why there's this term spiritual death. Actually, nothing dies. Nothing dies but the wrong view, the delusion that there's something to hold on in the first place. There's no real death. It's nothing to fear. What dies is the delusion. What emerges is reality. Sometimes we get it the wrong way around, don't we? We think that the world we create through our self-clinging is real, and all the talk of something that transcends self-clinging is somehow fantasy. Delusional fantasy, nice to think kind of fantasy. The reality is the other way around. We're living in a delusion, this side of enlightenment. What we let go of is that delusion into something real. And it's said that that's when this other law, this other niyama, dharma niyama, processes that are governed by that law start to operate. And Bhante uses the language of Dharma Niyama because he wants us to be really careful not to literalise or reify that language. Dharma Niyama isn't a thing. It's just like gravity isn't a thing. It's a set of laws in the universe that naturally arise in us when we start to let go of self-clinging. And they open us up to yet a stream of mental states that are not selfishly based. They open us up to the dynamics of the real dynamics of what it is to be human. They lead to compassionate activity. But it's said that a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, an enlightened being, doesn't feel compassionate. They just experience this freedom from selfhood. But their action in the world, as we experience it, looks like compassion. It's a bit like a lamp, the light of a lamp, and the lamp itself. The enlightened mind is the lamp itself, and the light that shines from it, that we see, is compassionate activity. They're not separate, and yet, a Buddha doesn't think around, go around thinking I'm being really compassionate. There's no self, sense of self there. And it's said that these states, at first, they're glimpsed like flashes of lightning. And it's very, very possible to have glimpses, even though we might not have been practicing either at all or for very long. It's very, very possible to have glimpses. But unless we're practicing, those glimpses just disappear. They arise. For a while, we might be lifted out of ourselves into a world of significance, of sacred meaning, and we know that there is something more in reality. But then we forget. We forget, and we just get on with the humdrum of our lives. Practice is about not worrying too much about those heightened experiences, but trying to live according to them, and building a spiritual life. I think Ken Wilber said that people these days, people he meant in spiritual circles, are far too concerned about spiritual experiences and not concerned enough about a spiritual life. Mm-hmm. And Bhante Sankaracharya has really emphasised a spiritual life. If we live a spiritual life, the experiences take care of themselves. And it's said that they become more and more frequent, they become more and more profound, they become more and more transformative, and until they become, in a way, the keynote of our lives. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the third part of my talk. I'm going to say less about this, but not because it's not really, really important. If we're going to live a spiritual life, if we're going to move towards real spiritual rebirth, then we're going to need to commit ourselves to the spiritual life. We're going to need commitment. Speaking personally again, so yes, 14 years ago, I was welcomed into the order by Subhuti. And as Subhadramati said, the ordination ceremony symbolises a spiritual rebirth. It symbolises a spiritual rebirth. It isn't necessarily a real spiritual rebirth in that it doesn't necessarily coincide with a real realisation that is going to be irreversible. But nevertheless, my own experience was that it was a turning point. It was a key turning point, and I'm not alone in that. I think most order members will talk in these terms as being the pivot on which their life has turned. Maitre Bandhu once said that he experienced it as just a tiny, tiny turning point that was really subtle. It's as if the compass of his life turned by just a degree or so. But over time, if you keep following that change of direction, you end up in a very, very different place. You end up in a very, very different place to had you not had that turning. And for me, that turning point, I'm still trying to unravel its implications, to grasp what it is that I did 14 years ago, what happened. But I just want to, speak a little bit more personally. So for me, I asked for ordination about 2 years after I'd first started coming along to the centre. And I wasn't sure that I was ready to ask. Part of me just thought, no, it's way too early. Who do you think you are, thinking that you can even ask to join the order? I kind of asked because others around me, friends around me, Maitre Raja, where are you? For example, Maitre Vera, who became a very, very close friend, asked for ordination. And I just moved in into a community, a residential community, founded by Maitre Bandhu and Paramabandhu, where apart from them two order members, everybody else, and apart from me, had asked for ordination. And I thought, drat. It was like, oh yes, I really, really want to do this. Really, really want to do this. But now if I ask, they'll think I'm just doing it because I'm copying my Trevira, who was the last person to ask. And so I thought, okay, well, what I'll do is I'll just wait. I'll wait for, you know, a good few months before asking. I waited 2 months and then I couldn't restrain myself and had to ask after a particularly significant sort of retreat. Actually, it was, a very significant retreat. I don't think it was Sibford, although Sibford was my first retreat. Anyway, I asked. Now, my point is that in retrospect, I don't think I would have asked had I not put myself in conditions where it was sort of normal to ask. Do you see what I mean? The culture at the time, and it's a bit, the reason I'm emphasising this is because the culture in our community has moved on, not in our residential community so much as in the Tree Rat community, has moved on. And it's moved on positively. But I want to just trace what it was like for me, 16, 17 years ago. In those days, it was very, very explicit that if you were serious about enlightenment, if you were serious about the spiritual life, if you were at all serious about practice, then the way to progress was to ask for ordination, to really prioritise the ordination process, get ordained, and then get on with committing the rest of your life to realising spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, really realising it. That was very, very explicit. It was also made very explicit that that required us to reprioritise all aspects of our life. Yeah? Reprioritise all aspects of our life. Now, for me, I was able to do that. I was able to move into a community. I was able to leave my job. I was able to start working here at the Buddhist Centre. Not everybody is able or was able. And unfortunately, the way of thinking and the way of communicating at the time meant that a lot of people felt left out through no fault of their own, simply because they weren't able to necessarily live the normative lifestyle of community and team-based right livelihood. Yeah. Maybe they had families already, maybe they didn't want to live in a community, maybe they had a job or a vocation that was already fulfilling. All sorts of things. So that culture, for some people, was really unhelpful. Other people, not myself, felt forced into conforming to a particular lifestyle that then later they found wasn't helpful. And besides, living in a community doesn't do it of its own accord, or even working at the Buddhist Centre doesn't do it, or working in Lama's pyjamas or whatever it is, doesn't do it of its own accord. It provides opportunities, and we have to be taking those opportunities. It's possible to put yourself in those conditions, not take those opportunities, not make any spiritual progress, and somebody not living in those conditions might make much, much, much more. So then, over time, this discourse changed. And what we started to emphasise was that there were lots of lifestyles whereby you could make spiritual progress. You didn't have to live this normative lifestyle, as long as it was ethical. And as long as you could practice, you could really, really make progress. And I think that's really positive, really, really positive. I was just on a meeting with chairmen, chairwomen from all over Europe just last week. And a lovely, lovely man that I've just started to get to know is the chair of the Ghent Centre in Belgium, Arthur Kusselin. He is... lives with his wife and three kids. Although the kids are more grown up now, when he asked for ordination and was training to be ordained, they were very young. And I was asking him about, well, I said to him, how did you do it? How did you manage to bring up a family, stay in your job, which was demanding, etc.? How did you do it and get ordained and make of his spiritual progress? And he looked at me and said, Nyanavacha, I went for refuge to the three jewels. And it was obvious, that's what you can do. In any situation you can do that, you can choose to do that. So yeah, we've entered into a more mature phase where we've emphasised that you don't have to live in a community like I do, or work in a Buddhist context like I do. Nevertheless, there's a danger there as well. because we can end up overemphasizing that, and then it starts to sound as if all lifestyles are equally favorable to spiritual progress, but they're not. They're not. Yeah. Of course, it's possible to make spiritual progress in a number of different lifestyles, but some lifestyles are more favorable than others. And that's where we all have to ask ourselves some hard questions. If we're attracted to the Dharma, we have to sort of start to say, how much commitment am I prepared to make? How much reprioritizing in my life am I prepared to make? And take responsibility for that. Because real spiritual death, real spiritual rebirth, isn't going to arise without giving it all that we can. And that requires commitment. So what I'm going to encourage us to do in this year ahead of us is, if we're all attracted, if we've glimpsed something of the ideal, if we're at all attracted by it, if we've been on perhaps just one retreat and realised that there is a different way of being, a different way of experiencing, what I'm going to suggest is that we don't forget that, that we really try and remember that value, that cherish, that glimpse, and then ask ourselves and perhaps ask those who are more experienced around us, how do we build on that? How do we take the next step? How do we move towards a deepening commitment towards reality? How do we move towards the truth? What do we need to reprioritize? And let's try and have the courage to act in that way in this year of spiritual rebirth. Just to take the next step. It will be different for each of us. It doesn't necessarily mean getting ordained. It doesn't necessarily mean asking for ordination, although it can mean those things. It will be different for each of us. But we can ask ourselves, and we can ask others around us who perhaps have more experience than ourselves. Okay. So I'm going to move on to the last part of my talk. So Bhante has, as I say, and Subhuti has recently been talking about spiritual rebirth in terms of these processes that arise in accordance with the Dharma Niyama, with the law of the law that is called the Dharma Niyama. These processes that arise somehow. They arise sort of within us and yet are nothing to do with us, and yet are essentially what it is to be human. So somehow they're essentially to do with us. And I think that what Bhante is trying to do is really trying to help us avoid literalism. He's using his language very carefully, probably much more carefully than I have just used it tonight, so that we don't slip into misunderstandings, particularly literalism. But there is a bit of a danger of any language, and I think one of the dangers of, well, danger is not the right word, but one of the drawbacks of talking about processes that arise in accordance with the law of conditionality that is governed by, categorised by the Dharma Niyama, is that it all sounds a bit technical. It all sounds a bit abstract. Well, Subhuti and Bhante have also used other language. They've used metaphor. They've used more metaphorical language. The key thing is to remember that it is metaphor. And yet, metaphors can point to reality more directly and more truly than concepts can, at least sometimes. So we need a metaphorical language. We need our imagination. Imagination is the faculty that will lead to a direct experience of reality, not our reason, alone. Imagination somehow includes and transcends reason. That film, Nostalgia for the Light, yeah, I just want to touch on it again, actually, and I don't know if you'll be able to see the connection. I'm not sure I can bring out the connection. I just wanted to say this. There's an interview with a woman that, towards the very end of the film, she lost both her parents in Pinochet's regime, and she was a child when they disappeared. She can remember the night that they came and took her parents away for being suspected dissidents. She was brought up by her grandparents, and she talks about how she has grown up and still feels, she's a mother now, she's grown up and still feels that there's something missing, not just in her life, but in her very being. she says that it's as if she was sort of delivered from the factory with a missing part. There's something missing in her that's wrong. And nobody can see it from the outside, but she lives with its absence all the time. All the time. And sometimes it's more painful than at other times. Sometimes it's unbearable. And she's also an astronomer. She's also an astronomer, a cosmologist. And she says, when it gets like that, she contemplates the stars. She contemplates the cosmos, the universe. And she contemplates the fact that even the stars are impermanent, that there is nothing permanent out there, that we are made of, as it were, the same stuff as the stars, and it is always flowing. And that what she says is that she feels connected at those times, and it brings her some relief. That perspective brings her some relief. That, to me, is the imagination at its best, in the words of somebody who isn't a Buddhist. Yeah. She's moving towards truth. Recently, Bhante and Subhuti have talked about how it feels when reality starts to break through. Again, this is metaphorical language. They've said that it feels like there's a force that comes through, a force, a will, that's beyond us, that isn't our own, and yet sort of is not our own. And it arises within us. And it leads to compassionate activity. Subhuti refers to it as a suprapersonal force. The paper that he talks about this in has just come out a couple of weeks ago. I'd really recommend you read it. It's called A Suprapersonal Force Working Through Me. It's on Subhuti's website, so you can find it online. But another language that Bhante has used and emphasised is the language of images. It's the language of images. Because even the notion of a suprapersonal force can sound too abstract. And the actual experience is not abstract. It feels intensely personal. It's said that we can feel like we're in contact with a consciousness wider than our own, not our own. As if there's a presence, a consciousness, not our own. A consciousness that is full of wisdom and love. And so the Buddhist tradition has personified the experience in images like the image that we've got on our shrine, this image of Manjugosha. Because there's truth in it. Not because it's fantasy, but because this is what this and the other images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is what it feels like when we're in contact with reality. This is what the glimpse will feel like. It will feel like we're in contact with a presence that's radiantly beautiful, radiantly beautiful, radiantly wise, radiantly kind, compassionate. It'll feel like we're in contact with a presence. That's what it will feel like. This image is an image of Manjugosha, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. He personifies all the wisdoms of the Buddhas. And I'm going to draw to a close by just talking a little bit about this image. So yeah, Manjugosha is the figure that I meditate upon. When you're ordained into the Srivatna Buddhist community, if you want to, you're given the opportunity to be introduced to a meditation practice with one of these archetypal figures. And I meditate upon Manjugosha. Actually, he wasn't the figure that I chose or chose me when I was ordained. He emerged several years later. He started to emerge in dreams. And sometimes in meditations, sort of involuntary. It was as if he was just emerging. And in one dream, it was very, very clear. I got a letter from Subhuti who said, I now want you to take up the Manjugosha practice. So I did, in consultation with him. In this image, this image was painted for me by Chintamani. He's emerging from the sun in the cosmos. It's as if he's become an embodiment of the sun as the source of all life, all light, epitomizing, the source of everything. But the sun is also that incandescent object that burns away all egotism. And he's emerging from that. He is that personification. He's coming out of the sun. He's holding this flaming sword of wisdom that cuts through delusion. In his heart, to his heart, he's holding the Book of Wisdom. The Book of Wisdom feels like, in the image to me, a crystallization of the whole cosmos that he's holding to his heart. And the sun itself is emerging from this galactic cloud, this cloud nebula in which stars are born. And the cosmos where stars are born out of sort of nothing, for me, becomes a symbol of form and emptiness. The truth that there is no fixed entities, that there is just flow. Manjigosha emerges from the sun itself, emerging from this cloud itself, emerging from this cosmos. At his heart, he's holding this book, which is a crystallization of that very truth. And he's beautiful. He's beautiful. And in my heightened moments, I experience that beauty. And then there's much that, well, there's nothing much I can say. He's said to have a radiantly gentle voice. Gosha means voice. Manju means gentle. And, his voice is said to have 64 different types of qualities. It's a whisper of kindness. It's a lion's roar. It's the sound of a thundercloud waking us up, trying to wake us up from our slumber. It's a voice that leads us to an experience that is the fulfillment of human life, the fulfillment of all life, the realization of the meaning that we're all searching for, the fulfillment, you could say, of the cosmos itself, of reality itself. It's the voice of a wisdom that takes us beyond all words.